Today on the program, we explore the complex and important world of engineering, how people use science to solve problems or invent new things.
Well, I believe real engineers need to engineer things, need to envision what has never been, and to build things every semester.
We sent reporter Karen Leggett out to live in the engineering world. Over the past few months, she interviewed officials at the National Academy of Sciences, an engineer at the U.S. Geological Survey, engineering educators, and an engineering professor in India, among others. She learned how engineering students are being taught. Believe it or not, some of them are reading literature to help them learn how to become better engineers. Now, back from the world of engineering, here is Karen Leggett.
Think about the great engineering successes of the 20th century. What would you include? We could start with airplanes. How about radio and television broadcasts or computers? In 2008, the National Academy of Engineering asked a group of scientists, engineers, and technology experts to identify the biggest engineering challenges for the 21st century. This group identified 14 big challenges or issues. They divided these issues into four subject areas: sustainability, health, reducing threats, and joy of living. Joy of living? What does that have to do with engineering? Rick Miller is president of the Olin College of Engineering.
Well, not everything that we think about going forward is a threat to the human race. Some of it is about joy and improving the quality of life. One of the things that is certainly true in the U.S., and I believe it's increasingly true across the globe, is the expectation that every generation will have a quality of life that exceeds that of their parents.
Mr. Miller says part of engineering today is about making life better. For example, engineers can help provide clean water for more people, or they can improve medicines. Engineering can help us understand how the human brain works and how every person can learn best. All these efforts are part of improving the quality of life. In other words, they help to increase the joy of living. Experts say engineering can help the world become safer and more efficient in the 21st century. They say engineers could design ways to prevent terrorists from using nuclear weapons, or they could stop computer hackers from stealing information on the Internet. Engineers can make it easier to use energy from the sun or find new sources of energy. Rick Miller says engineers have to work together to solve many challenges. The issues are too large and complex for any one group of engineers or one country to solve alone. Mr. Miller says that when engineers from around the world cooperate, they can save the planet. But he says before engineers can start solving the world's problems, they need to learn how to think creatively. His school, Franklin W. Olin College, was recently recognized for developing engineering leaders.
Creativity is an important part of what we do. We look for students with multiple intelligences, not just math scores. Olin believes that an engineer is a person who envisions what has never been and does whatever it takes to make it happen.
Olin College is a small engineering school in the state of Massachusetts. Its students learn through creative projects. Mr. Miller says, for example, a student might design an insect, such as a grasshopper. In 5 weeks, students have to create the design, build a model, and then compete to see whose grasshopper jumps the highest. Olin College students also identify people they would like to help. Some students have invented ways to help older adults suffering from memory loss. Others have created designs to help servers in coffee shops do their jobs better. Mr. Miller says he wants his engineering students to work at being engineers just like art students practice making art.
Real musicians need to play music every semester. And in fact, it's like oxygen. Well, I believe real engineers need to engineer things, need to envision what has never been, and to build things every semester.
Olin College is not the only school that teaches students how to think about engineering challenges. Pennsylvania State University offers what it calls the Humanitarian Engineering Social Entrepreneurship Program. In other words, students use engineering to improve people's lives. In one project, students developed and tested low-cost greenhouses in Kenya. Greenhouses are used for growing plants. These enclosed areas give farmers a longer growing season. Other college engineering programs are giving students a chance to create products and launch businesses before they finish their education. For example, engineering students at Rice University in Texas have designed 58 healthcare products. The university says the products are now used to care for 45,000 patients in 21 countries. In North Carolina, classes at a new secondary school are organized around the grand challenges of the 21st century. Rob Matheson is head of the STEM Early College High School. STEM stands for the words science, technology, engineering, and math.
What struck me, again, as a science educator, is that the challenges really cut across all of the basic sciences that we teach, earth science, life, and chemical. The answers to these big questions, like access to clean water, is in the humanities.
Rob Matheson's students not only take engineering classes, they also study literature and history. He says students might read books like The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind by William Kamkwamba. This book tells the true story of a boy in Malawi who built a windmill to bring electricity to his village. Another assigned reading might be Lord of the Flies by William Golding. The book tells about a group of boys alone on an island.
They read Lord of the Flies, and then the project is, you know, imagine that you crash-landed on this island, and how are you going to sustain yourself? How are you going to provide the energy that you need?
Mr. Matheson believes students should learn early in their education to make connections between science and people.
The question nowadays is, well, what are you doing with your chemistry knowledge? What process or product are you producing that's benefiting mankind? As opposed to just, I know my chemistry.
Two large internet companies, Facebook and Google, recently purchased two India-based technology startup companies. India is home to tens of thousands of computer software engineers and a growing information technology industry. The sales of the startup companies are expected to influence others to launch businesses in the country. Facebook closed its deal to buy Little Eye Labs in early January. Four engineers in Bangalore launched Little Eye Labs about a year and a half ago. The company builds mobile application software tools. The deal is said to be worth between $10 and $15 million. It is the first time Facebook has purchased an Indian startup company. Google bought the cybersecurity company Imperium. Imperium has offices in Bangalore and California. Media reports set the value of the deal at about $9 million. The two deals are considered small but important. Experts say they will help increase interest in Indian startups among foreign technology companies. Such businesses often buy small companies, either for the technology they develop or the ability of their creators. Rutvik Doshi is with Inventus Capital Partners, an investment company in Bangalore.
Till date, none of these large U.S. companies had ever acquired anything in India. You know, nothing to write home about. If they both turn out to be successful for these respective companies, they will then now start looking at India more seriously in terms of there is more talent, there is more technology and entrepreneurship happening here.
Indian software engineers have gained recognition around the world. Most of the engineers work for big Indian technology companies, but the number of Indian technology startup companies is on the rise. Raising money for these startups is not always easy. Rajesh Sahani helped to create a company called GSF Accelerator. It provided financial support for Little Eye Labs. Mr. Sahani says most of the startups in India have worked on developing products for the home market. But he says the recent deals with Facebook and Google will lead investors and business people to widen their efforts.
The time now is to encourage these startups to start thinking global. And that's what the internet allows today. We need to encourage our bright young talent in India to now start building products for world market like Israelis have done or like U.S. startups do.
Bangalore's successful technology services and outsourcing industry mostly does back office work for Western companies. But this work has put India on the technology map. The success that the industry has created will help open the door to future growth.
Today we tell about Abraham Lincoln, the 16th President of the United States.
Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We here, hold the power and bear the responsibility.
That was actor Henry Fonda speaking the words of President Lincoln. This recitation is part of A Lincoln Portrait, a work by American composer Aaron Copland. Today, we tell the story of this great American president. Come along with us. The words we just heard were part of a speech President Lincoln gave to the United States Congress in 1862. At the time, he was leading the nation during the Civil War. This was the most serious crisis in American history. Lincoln spoke to lawmakers a month before he signed the Emancipation Proclamation. The document declared the freedom of slaves in states controlled by rebel forces. Abraham Lincoln was born in Kentucky on February 12, 1809. He grew up in Illinois. His family was poor and had no education. Abraham Lincoln taught himself what he needed to know. He became a lawyer. He served in the Illinois State Legislature and in the United States Congress. In 1860, he was elected to the country's highest office. President Lincoln helped end slavery in the nation, and he helped keep the American Union from splitting apart during the Civil War. Lincoln believed that democracy can be a lasting form of government. In 1863, the president gave what became his most famous speech. Union armies of the North had won two great victories that year. They defeated the Confederate armies of the South at Vicksburg, Mississippi, and at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Ceremonies were held to honor the dead soldiers on the Gettysburg battlefield. President Lincoln spoke at Gettysburg for only about 2 minutes, but his speech has never been forgotten. Historians say it defined Americans as a people who believed in freedom, democracy, and equality. The speech began, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of it as a final resting place for those who died here, that the nation might live. Abraham Lincoln wrote some of the most memorable words in American history. Lincoln was assassinated in 1865. He was shot at Ford's Theater in Washington while he and his wife were watching a play. He died a few days after the Civil War ended. Yet his words live on. In 1942, orchestra conductor Andre Kostolanitz asked three leading American composers to write musical portraits of famous Americans. One of the three was Aaron Copland. His compositions were often based on traditional American music. In a conversation recorded at the Library of Congress in 1975, on his 75th birthday, Copland recalled,
"I picked Lincoln, and after I decided to do a musical portrait of Lincoln, I began looking around at some of the biographies of him, and I found a very interesting one by an English lord, a man called Lord Charnwood, of all things. And it was in there that I found some of the quotes that I used in the work itself."
Aaron Copland wrote a Lincoln portrait for speaker and symphony orchestra. The speaker recites words taken from Lincoln's speeches, letters, and the Gettysburg Address. In our conversation in 1975, Copland remembered the very first speaker.
It was Carl Sandburg, the great biographer of Lincoln, so that one had full confidence that he knew what he was talking about.
And did Copland have a favorite speaker over the many years a Lincoln portrait has been performed?
I've heard it done by so many different people in so many different ways that it's hard for me really to decide on, in my own mind, who has the perfect way. Obviously, if you get someone with Sandburg's personality, whom one connects with Lincoln in some way or other, that helps a great deal.
Copland added a note for the speaker to the score for a Lincoln portrait. It reads that the words are meant to be read simply and directly, without a trace of exaggerated sentiment. It is the composer's wish that the speaker depend for his effect not on his acting ability, but on his complete sincerity of manner. In 1968, Copland led the London Symphony Orchestra with Henry Fonda speaking the words of Lincoln in just the way the composer preferred.
Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. That is what he said. That is what Abraham Lincoln said. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. He was born in Kentucky, raised in Indiana, and lived in Illinois. And this is what he said. This is what Abe Lincoln said. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. When standing erect, he was 6 feet 4 inches tall, and this is what he said. He said, "It is the eternal struggle between two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. It is the same spirit that says, you toil and work and earn bread, and I'll eat it, no matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race, it is the same tyrannical principle." Lincoln was a quiet man. Abe Lincoln was a quiet and a melancholy man. But when he spoke of democracy, this is what he said. He said, "As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master." This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy. Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of these United States, is everlasting in the memory of his countrymen. For on the battleground at Gettysburg, this is what he said. He said that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Henry Fonda, with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the composer, in Aaron Copland's A Lincoln Portrait.